Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Eric Holtz-Gimenez. He is the executive director of Food First, and his new book is Can We Feed the World Without Destroying It? And he has been a guest on my show before, but I've asked him to come back to talk about this latest book, and we will invite him on in just a bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city, talk to you about some things going on in the news, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. First off, I'm sure many of you have been reading about the cancellation of recycling programs around the country. I know here on Long Island, where I live, they have canceled many of the recycling programs in towns just because they don't know where to ship it to. China and India don't want our garbage anymore. Some of that might have to do with the trade deals our man in the White House is negotiating. But nevertheless, recycling here in this country is just proving to be too expensive. Some of the cities are still recycling and then just sending all of the recycling to landfills. Some towns are choosing to burn it, trying to channel it into energy, and yet at the same time that's just adding to the greenhouse gas emissions, so that's not a great thing, burning plastic. So what are we to do? And it comes down to all of our consumption. We need to stop buying things that are in plastic. We need to reuse our glass jars. When you get a bottle of jam at the store, don't just throw that out. Wash it out and save it and use that as a storage container. We need to reuse these things until this issue gets fixed. I hope, one of these smart youngsters that are in school come up with some innovative ideas as to ways to recycle and products to use from the post-recycling waste. But meanwhile, we really have to reduce what we are consuming. So give that some thought as you shop and choose what foods to buy. And of course, we're coming into the time where we can start going to farmers markets soon again, and that will certainly cut down on the plastic. As someone who loves to buy organic, it kills me when I have to buy my organic lettuce in these plastic containers. But it seems like I have no choice most of the time. So that's really great. But that was really disturbing news to see that. And then also the plight of dairy farmers right now is really, really a serious issue. We've heard of dairy farmers having problems with the competition with farms that are buying up the small organic dairy farms. And yet promoting their product as organic when the reality is those cows never see the light of day. They have thousands of cows and, they're really not meeting the organic standards, but our organic standards have gotten so weak from the infiltration of industry into our organic standards board that is also a problem. But on top of that, ICE is really coming down on so many of the dairy farmers. They know that dairy farmers depend on undocumented workers to keep their farms going. And as a result, even though they might not be able to come onto the farms, they hang out at the supermarkets and the grocery stores where the undocumented workers need to go sometimes to get gas or get food. And then they bust them. And once they bust one of them, then they have grounds to come onto the farm and bust the rest of them. And so it's really a problem. And there are certain programs that the USA sponsors that allows undocumented workers to come over temporarily to help on farms. But those are for seasonal workers. And dairy farmers work year-round. It's not a seasonal job. They are milking those cows all winter long. And so they need farmers they need help all the time. And so that's really a problem. And dairy farmers are just having such a hard time staying afloat as it is with the reduction of people even drinking milk and eating dairy. There's so many other types of milk these days, cashew milk, almond milk, soy milk, pea protein milk, you name it. So anyway, it's just a problem. I don't really have an answer, but it's just a problem and something to think about. When you're buying organic dairy, really make sure that you're buying it from a small organic dairy farmer who's really doing it right. And when I say doing it right, organic farmers also are helping to replenish the soil, helping to sequester carbon from the atmosphere into the ground. And that is a good thing where, you know, the other farmers that are really not meeting the organic standards are not doing that. So when you are buying direct from a farmer or choosing to buy from a small farmer, you know that you're doing a better thing. And you can actually look at, there's a website, Cornucopia Institute. They have score sheets. They have score sheets for eggs. They have score sheets for milk and dairy. And so you can know whether or not that farm that you're buying from is really meeting the standards that we want to consider organic. So check that out. Also, let's see, what else do I want to talk to you all about? I want to share with you my recipe this week. Red lentil and coconut soup with ginger and black rice. This recipe was inspired from Deborah Madison's book, Vegetable Literacy, which is a beautiful book if you haven't seen it. And she has a red lentil and coconut soup recipe in there. And I really use that as a guide. I just made some changes. So I really credit this recipe to her. And of course, I doubled it because her recipe was for like four people, and I rarely make anything for just four people. So this feeds 6 to 8 people. 2.5 cups of red lentils that you want to rinse first and pick through in case there's any little rocks in there. 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, 2 onions chopped, 2 carrots chopped, a 2-inch piece of ginger minced, 1 tablespoon chopped garlic, 2 teaspoons turmeric, 2 teaspoons curry powder, 4 teaspoons cumin, and 4 teaspoons of black mustard seeds. Then you're going to take a bunch of cilantro stems and mince those. And you're going to use that as an ingredient as well. 1 quart of coconut cream. You can use 2 cans of coconut milk or coconut cream if you don't have a quart. But this is not the coconut milk that you use as a in place of regular milk. This is, you know, thicker than the kind that you get on the dairy shelves. 8 cups of water, 4 teaspoons of salt, and then 2 cups of baby spinach. And that you can even use 4 cups of baby spinach if you want. I made the soup and then I thought to myself, I'd like to see even a little more spinach in here. And then on the side, you're going to cook up some black rice. I cooked up 2 cups of black rice, or I used 1 cup to net 2 cups of cooked black rice. 4 limes that you're going to serve with the soup. Some Japanese ground red pepper. I use a mixture that has red pepper and sesame seeds called Kanami Tagarashi. But anyways, ground cayenne pepper would work as well if you don't have that. And that's just to sprinkle into the soup to give it a little heat. And then you're going to garnish the soup also with cilantro or parsley. And you're going to start by rinsing the lentils and then cover them with cold water and set them aside. And meanwhile, in a heavy pot, you're going to saute the onions and the carrots in the coconut oil for about 5 minutes. If it starts sticking, instead of adding any more oil, I just add a little water to continue sauteing, 1 tablespoon of water at a time. Just continue sauteing. Then you're going to add the garlic and the ginger, along with the turmeric, the curry powder, the cumin, and the mustard seeds, and the cilantro stems, and cook that for about 5 more minutes, stirring constantly. And again, if it starts sticking to the bottom, just add a tablespoon of water to deglaze it. And then you're going to drain the lentils and add them to the pot and let those saute those for another couple minutes to let them get covered with the spices. Then you're going to add the coconut cream, the salt, and the water. And you're going to bring the water to a boil, then reduce the heat to a simmer and let that cook for 30 to 40 minutes. They'll start getting soft after 20, but you want them to really be soft and kind of start falling apart and become a cream soup. And the soup will get really creamy just by cooking it like that. taste it, and you can adjust the salt and the spices if you'd like. And if you want to add the cayenne pepper to the whole pot at this point, you can. But like I said, I usually serve it on the side so people can add it to their own. And then right before serving, you're going to add the spinach leaves and allow them just a minute to wilt in the soup. And then you're going to ladle the soup into bowls. Add a spoonful of the black rice right in the middle. So that's beautiful. When I was eating the leftovers and I didn't want to heat things up separately, I just put the rice right into a small soup pot to heat it up, and it changed the color totally. So it wasn't as pretty if you mix the rice right in. So it's really nice to serve the rice in the middle. And then you're going to garnish with cilantro or parsley. I like cilantro, but some people don't. And then serve it with a lime wedge, and you're going to encourage people to squeeze the lime right before eating it and mix that up. And it's really, really quite delicious like that. And then there's a couple take actions that I'd like to encourage you to do. Right now, there's some grants that are available to promote health, healthy lunches in your school, and also to get some school gardens going. And so you can go to the website Action for Healthy Kids and check out what they offer. They have grants to improve your school breakfast, grants to start school gardens, and there's also Every Kid Healthy Week coming up April 22nd to 26th. And so they have ideas for that too. So you might want to check that out. And then there's also a petition on my website to try to encourage the Trump administration, or let our officials know that we don't want those cuts to the SNAP program and to Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security that our president has proposed. So sign those as well. And, you know, just be active. You know, I always talk to all of you about that. You know, we all can't fix all the problems that are going on. It's just too many. But we can all do something. So find an issue that you're passionate about and become active in it. Really try to own it and do something about it. A few things that are coming up in the New York area that I want to tell you about in case you want to participate. If you're thinking about starting a garden, you don't know where to get started, Queens County Farm is hosting a beginning vegetable gardening class starting this Saturday, March 23rd. So you can go onto the Queens County Farm website. I also have a link on my website at ieatgreen.com. The New York City CUNY School of Public Health, they are having their monthly seminar this month. It's Eating Without Reservations, Ensuring Food Safety in New York City. Those are always great events. They start at 8:30. They serve a healthy breakfast, and it goes until 10, and they're really great. Also, starting March 26th, Elijah Farm, which is a wonderful organic farm on Long Island, they are starting a culinary series starting Tuesday, March 26th. From 5:30 to 6:30, they're only an hour class, but you can sign up for the whole series. It's very reasonable. Again, there's a link on my website, or you can go to Elijah Farm's website to find out more about that. Local Roots, which is a New York City CSA, they were guests on my show a few weeks ago. They are having an event on March 26th as well called The Healing Benefits of Eating Seasonally. And that's at ONS Clothing on Green Street in Soho. Wellness in Schools, they are having their New York City Gala on April 2nd. Very pricey, but if you are in that circle where you can afford it, it's a great organization to support. So check that out, Wellness in the Schools. Again, I have links to all of these things on my website. The New England Farm to Institution Conference is coming up April 2nd to 5th. That's up at Amherst at the University of Massachusetts, a great thing to participate in. And then in New York City, April 5th and 6th is the conference Beyond Pesticides. That's the 37th National Pesticide Forum. That takes place at the New York Academy of Medicine. That's a wonderful event. I will be there, and it ends with a screening of Ground War, which is the New York City premiere at the Florence Gould Hall Theater. at 7:45 on April 6th. And that film is about all the pesticides that they spray on our golf courses and our children's soccer fields, et cetera, and how poisonous that is to our health. So lots of other things going on. But the last one I want to mention to you that I am organizing on April 13th, it's being sponsored by NOFA New York, Slow Food North Shore, and the Long Island Food Consortium. We are sponsoring a Long Island CSA fair, and that is going to be at the Sisters of St. Joseph on April 13th from 11 to 3. We will serve refreshments. So far, we have 18 organic farms signed up that will present to you their different CSA options. And all CSAs are not the same. And it's really a wonderful opportunity to see meet all the farmers under one roof and to compare the different programs and see which one's right for you. They all have different drop-off points. Some you pick up at the farm. Some actually have home delivery. Some, you know, different days of the week. Most of them you have to pay up front, but some of them have payment plans. So if you can't afford to pay all up front, you know, some have options for meat or fish or dairy or eggs or flowers or fruit. You know, so there's all these different options. So come on out to the CSA fair. It's going to be a fun day, and we look forward to seeing all of you there. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Eric Holt Jimenez. He is an agroecologist, a political economist, a lecturer, and author, and he's written many books. His latest book, Can We Feed the World Without Destroying It?, takes a look at the root causes of hunger and how we can address the problem. Eric has been the executive director of Food First since 2006, and Food First is a nonprofit organization that works to end the injustices that cause hunger through research, education, and action. Eric, are you with me?
I'm right here.
Great. So let's start by talking about your book. Can We Feed the World Without Destroying It?
Well, first, thank you for this invitation to your program, Ivana.
Sure.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Well, let's interrogate that title a bit. Can We Feed the World Without Destroying It? Because I think that's a very interesting question. You know, 50 years ago, there didn't seem to be a doubt in anyone's mind, at least not the experts, that the Green Revolution was going to feed the world. In other words, the new high-yielding varieties of rice and corn and wheat, coupled with fertilizers,
soy,
powerful pesticides, and machinery and irrigation, were going to increase production to such an extent that as long as we controlled for overpopulation, everybody was going to get fed. And we were just going to sort of spread these technologies around the world, and all the farmers of the world were going to feed everybody. But, you know, now we're not so sure.
Right.
When you look at the global food system, you see a lot of problems. Even while some people do struggle to put food on the table, many people struggle. A third of the world's population struggles. But a lot of the problems that we have are really much more related to overproduction than they are related to scarcity. I mean, if you look at the problems, a lot of the environmental problems in terms of our waste, you know, the tremendous amount of waste in the food system comes from overproduction. And we produce 1.5 times more than enough food to feed every man, woman, and child on the planet. And so we see a lot of this extra food going into some very sort of perverse technologies and products like, you know, ethanol or grain-fed beef, the CAFOs, which are highly, highly polluting. You know, the way that we produce food now is as concerning as the production of food itself, or having enough food itself, because we've lost a good 75% of the world's agrobiodiversity. Our food system uses up 80% of the planet's fresh water. And, you know, we're losing, every year we lose something like 75 billion tons of fertile soil. And then, you know, we see these extreme weather events, from global warming, to which agriculture contributes nearly a quarter of the greenhouse gases. The terrible, you know, sort of vicious feedback loop, which then affects agriculture itself. So, you know, I think that the can we see the world without destroying it is, we also have to ask, you know, and not kill ourselves in the process.
Right. Well, it's such a big problem. Where does one even start to remedy it?
Well, I think the first thing we have to realize is that we have been producing 1.5 times more than enough food to feed everyone on the planet for the last 50 years. In other words, about 1 in 7 people were going hungry 50 years ago when we launched the Green Revolution. And 1 in 7 people are going hungry today, if not more. And yet, we've been producing about 12% more food per capita every year for the last half century. That means that you and I and everybody else should have gotten 12% more food every year. That doesn't matter that population growth has increased, because it's a per capita measurement. And yet we haven't made any inroads against hunger. So I think that's the first thing we have
to look at.
Actually,
isn't it true that there's more hungry people today than there even was 50 years ago?
Well, you know, a lot of that depends on how you measure things. There are more hungry people today. Proportionally, it's about the same, you know, because our global population has grown. But the measurement of hunger and how many hungry people we have is actually a very political exercise. So we kind of have to look at how hunger is measured and then ask, well, wait a minute, who is hungry? To begin to get at what's wrong with the food system.
Right. And then even those that aren't hungry, they might not be hungry, but they're still malnourished because the quality of the food has gone down so much.
Yeah, right. Of course, we've got the problem of the
And the marketing of the junk food to everybody, because we have 1.5 times enough food for everyone. So, you know, we have food companies pushing and competing to help us stuff our faces with more food than we need, and the wrong kinds of food on top of that.
Yeah, and I think that people don't realize what an impact that industry, which is based on overproduction of food, has on our farmers. So when food is overproduced, the price paid to farmers goes down. And the price paid to farmers has been going down for over 50 years. And when that happens, farmers have to get bigger in order to stay in business. And small farmers go out of business. That happens in this country, and that happens around the world. And so what we're seeing is that the hungriest people in the world are actually farmers. And these are very small farmers who keep getting smaller and smaller as farms get bigger and bigger, gobbling up the land and the resources. Now, these small farmers, there's a lot of them, you know, almost a third of humanity works on farms. And these small farms produce over half of the world's food on only a quarter of the world's agricultural land. And most of these farmers are women. And then you take a look and realize that women make up 70% of the world's hungry. Women farmers, women and girls. So I think it's really sort of criminally ironic that the women who feed the world, after they get done feeding us, go hungry. And the reason is that prices are so low and they have such small plots of land that, you know, once they've sold their product on the market, which they have to sell right away because they're poor, the stores that they have, their own grain stores, run out, and then they have to buy food, and that's where they go hungry. So I think that the problem with the industrial food system, which we've developed over the last 50 years, is that it creates too many poor farmers. And in doing so, it creates too many hungry people, and it creates too many environmental problems for us and too much bad food for us. So when we talk about can we feed the world without destroying it, we're really looking at making profound structural changes to our food and farming systems.
And as an expert in that field, what are your suggestions? How do we make changes? What needs to be undone first?
Right. Well, you know, most of the time, this question is answered in terms of technology. You know, can we just introduce a new technology which produces more food and is less environmentally destructive? And I think that that's not quite the right way to frame it. This isn't a technological problem. It's really a political problem about the distribution of food-producing resources around the world. But also in terms of the technologies which have been advanced, those have to be changed. And luckily, there have been, all this time, and are increasingly, other approaches to agriculture. The approaches which we call agroecology, that basically basically works with nature, that uses the natural cycles, the carbon cycles, the nitrogen cycles, and the water cycles, and uses biodiversity in order to produce food productively. These are highly productive systems in ways that don't need any or much outside chemicals, and which are very water conserving, and by the way, are very resilient because they are so diverse to severe weather events of climate change. So the question is, how do we support those types of agricultural technologies and forms of production and disincentivize the more destructive and overproducing forms of production from the Green Revolution? And there are some sort of key aspects which we have to look at. So one is realize that the problem is overproduction, not scarcity. That's really creating a problem. That's driving poor farmers out of business. It's using up our resources. It's producing a lot of greenhouse gases. You have but to look at the CAFOs here in the United States to see how polluting they are. It also basically, you know, destroys the economies of the countryside. That it destroys
and
small farms.
How does the subsidies affect the overproduction?
So they don't affect overproduction. That's sort of the myth that, unfortunately, a lot of environmentalists promote, that if we would just stop subsidizing farmers, that would solve the problem. We shouldn't be subsidizing them. Well, we shouldn't be subsidizing them, but you can't just take away the subsidies because then all kinds of family farms will go bankrupt. Subsidies come in to support overproduction. In other words, prices are very low to farmers, and farmers, to make up for their fixed costs, produce more in order to make a living. Grain companies love this. The retail companies love this because they get to buy things cheaply. But then farmers go out of business, so the taxpayer comes along behind and provides subsidies so the farmers don't go out of business. Well, it barely keeps them alive, and really that subsidy is just to hold the whole system in place. So the answer is, and this is what we did back in the 1930s during the New Deal, is to control oversupply. Don't let agriculture overproduce. Don't let the price drop down so low that farmers can't make a living. Establish a parity price, which is a price that allows farmers to make a living. They can cover their costs, make a profit, make a decent living. That's called parity. And to do that, you really have to control overproduction. So you have what's called supply management. There are lots of mechanisms to do this and figure this out. The missing piece, which was less integrated during the original New Deal and which we should think about now, is, okay, if a farmer is only going to be allowed a certain amount of production, but they're going to be insured a parity price, there's going to be environmental conditions on that. No, you can't pollute the waterways with nitrogen. No, you can't pollute the air with methane. There should be strict controls, as there are in other countries around the world, so that we make sure that we produce the right amount of foods, that farmers get a good price, and that we begin to regenerate on the agro ecosystems and start cooling the planet rather than heating it.
Okay, so what can listeners do? Like, how do we move our government in that direction? How do we, you know, I mean, right now, as we all know, there's such intertwined corruption between food producers, food retailers, manufacturers, industrial, chemical companies, et cetera, et cetera. It's so intertwined and everybody wants a piece of the profit. Where do we start? How do we undo the mess we have?
Yeah, and right. And of course, the power of the agribusiness lobby in Washington and the farm bill is unparalleled. I think that if we look in the past, the last time we had a major reform to our economy, it started with agriculture and the food system, and that was the New Deal, which was introduced after the crash of 1929 and to get us out of the Great Depression. And Roosevelt did exactly what I mentioned. He put supply management controls, he ensured a parity price to farmers, and he implemented vast environmental programs, conservation programs that put in the terracing systems that we still have today in much of the Midwest, the Conservation Corps, the American Agricultural Act, also distributed food, surplus food to poor people, and he put money in people's pockets so they could buy food and basically rebuild the economy. So we need to do those things again today. In other words, we need a whole systems change in order to address the problem of food and production and environment. If we can't, you know, we have even though we are not an agrarian society anymore, as we were in the 1930s, agriculture is central to our economy. We just don't see it. You know, when we have less people on the land than we have in prison, 1% of the population. So people don't really see the reality of farming and what overproduction does to farming communities. So what we really need is what we had in the 1930s, which we had powerful social movements in this country, which forced reforms. Roosevelt would not have been able to introduce the New Deal had there not been political will. And that political will came from massive protests from social movements and farmers' organizations, political parties, people in the street. That was tremendous, but that's what it takes. The problem today is that we don't have enough farmers. They can't do this on their own. So we really need to build alliances with our farmers in order to demand these types of things. And we've got the Green New Deal, the resolution has been introduced. It's a little weak on agriculture. It's not bad, but it's, you know, it's not fleshed out. We need to make sure that the same provisions that were in the original New Deal are in the Green New Deal. And the only way that's going to happen is if we have powerful social movements demanding it, articulating it. So, you know, next time you go to the farmer's market, don't just buy produce from your farmer. This isn't just a transactional. We can't allow ourselves to be limited to just a transactional relationship with our producers. Actually establish a social and a political relationship with these producers. We need strong farmers' unions. We need to protect, for example, the organic standards, which are being destroyed in order to let industry in and take over organics. Well, that's not going to happen just by voting with our fork. We have to vote with our vote, and we have to do more than that. We actually have to counter the powerful agribusiness lobby. There's only two ways to create political will. One is with money, which is what agribusiness uses, and the other is with people power, as happened in during the original New Deal. So that's what we've got to build. We've got to build powerful social movements, these very diverse social movements, very fragmented right now, the food movement, the farm movement, the climate movement. We've got to bring those together and really create the political clout that we need. So So when I look at initiatives like the Green New Deal, I feel like, well, I don't know if this is going to go through or not, but it certainly is a tremendous opportunity to build the movement that we need.
Mm-hmm. This is a good moment for us to just take a little break. And when we come back, I really would like to talk about the new Green Deal. And, you know, you said it's a little weak on the agricultural aspects. Let's talk about those, and let's talk about what we can do to really galvanize all these different political movements to come together to really create the power that we need to create. So everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest, Eric Holt Jimenez, is the author of the new book, Can We Feed the World Without Destroying It? Be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. And my guest, if you're just joining us, is Eric Holt Jimenez. He is the executive director of Food First and author of the new book, Can We Feed the World Without Destroying It? And Eric, right before the break, we were just going to talk about the Green New Deal and how that addresses some of these agricultural problems that we've been talking about. Can you get into that a little bit with us? Talk to us a little about the new Green Deal and where it might fall short and what needs to happen to really make it the new Green Deal that we want.
You know, I think the problem with many progressives is that we tend to look for technological solutions, and we also tend to look for sort of social service solutions to the problems. And these are very important, but we really need to be looking at structural solutions. We need to look at causes. And so I submit that the cause of both hunger and environmental destruction is this capitalist food system which overproduces and depends on very polluting technologies. So the Green New Deal suggests that we should support, you know, green agriculture. We should support other types of technologies that are not so polluting. And I think that that's good, but it's not enough. We have to change the basic rules. So in order to have what we call a just transition to a green economy, you know, starting with agriculture, which is so important to having a green economy, we really need parity pricing and environmentally regulated supply management. And by that, I mean that farmers need to get a fair price for their product. industry can't keep getting it on the cheap. And that would do one interesting thing. It would eliminate subsidies. If farmers got a fair price, they wouldn't need subsidies. So how do you keep farmers who have big, methane-spewing, manure-spewing CAFOs from just getting a better price for a product which is hurting us? Well, one, you institute supply management. And so each farm in the country is basically given a quota of how much they can produce, determined on how much you can produce without polluting the water table, without spewing out methane, with taking care of the land. Because so much of that pollution comes when farmers try to overproduce. They need to over-apply fertilizers, and of course that gets washed into the watershed and ends up destroying the Gulf of Mexico with these huge red tides, the dead zones, the size of Connecticut in the Gulf that we have. So we need environmentally regulated supply management. And the farmer's reward for producing that way, not too much, and in ways which protect the environment, are they get a fair price. Well, that immediately knocks out all the CAFOs, the combined animal feedlot operations. They can't do it. They won't be able to meet those standards. And so what we really need is a big CAFO buyout. We need to buy those things out. We need to dismantle them. We need to redistribute that land into the hands of the people who are willing to farm agroecologically and environmentally and in a way that doesn't destroy the environment or create greenhouse gases. We need to support diversified family farms. You know, our farms are all getting bigger, and they're also getting very, very small. But we're losing the middle in this country. And we're losing it because the bigger farms are better at overproducing, and all this product we send around the world, which then destroys the markets for the farmers around the world and gets them dependent on our food system. Well, they can feed themselves. And we have to let them feed themselves, which means we have to just stop overproducing. And I think under those conditions, you're going to see a flowering of family farms again. And then we need things like we need to invest in research. You know, the National Science Foundation invests something like, 1% in organic research. We need a lot more. We need to be most of the agricultural research should be for agroecology, organics, permaculture, regenerative agriculture, those types of things. You know, the seed, just the seed market, it's very hard to get good organic seeds. Why? Because we don't invest in them. So we need to invest in them. And the other thing we need to do is society needs to realize that we need to rebuild our countryside. We need to invest in the countryside. We need to make the countryside a good place to live. So we need health, education, and welfare in the countryside. That's called the social wage. And if we have those things in the countryside, public services, public goods, then farmers don't need to make tremendous amounts of money because they're accessing public goods for their livelihoods. And I think finally what we need to do is we need to break up the monopolies. It's good to hear Elizabeth Warren talk about breaking up the tech monopolies, but we need to break up the agribusiness monopolies. And particularly we need to break up the big retailers, because they're the ones that got the vice grip on the food system. So we need to introduce our, reforms again. And we need to apply our antitrust laws, and we need to strengthen them. And if we do that, we're going to see a tremendous photosynthetic drawdown of the greenhouse gases. There's nothing like photosynthesis for capturing carbon. And if we regenerate family farms, diversified family farms with woodlots and pastures and grass-fed beef and very low external input systems, we're going to turn, not only are we going to turn hunger around, we're going to turn global warming around. And I would, just to finish off, I would say we also have to look at our cities. We have to green the cities, and we have to support farming in the cities. There's so much idle land in the city, and so many people, food insecure people, who can't feed themselves. And we have tremendous examples of this happening. Here in the New York City area, for example, tremendous rise of urban farms and urban gardens. We really need to support that. And the limiting factor to all of this is that people don't have land. We need to ensure land access to everyone who wants to farm.
And also to, make sure that they're farming in the right way. And luckily, most of the urban farms and small farmers are doing that. They're, really caring about how they're growing it, unlike the bigger farms out in the West.
Yeah, I think it's actually a very simple matter of establishing thresholds for emissions and pollutants. In other words, you cannot emit more nitrogen or methane or carbon than X amount. And then supporting farmers, whether they're urban or rural, in transitioning towards technologies and forms of agriculture and methods of management which can ensure that they stay within those parameters. And again, those real structural issues, which we know about from the New Deal, like supply management and parity pricing, would create the conditions for the transformation, not just of agriculture, but of our entire food system and the rest of our economy. And, I think that I really like that the Green New Deal talks about living wage jobs and public banks and equity and addressing the conditions of frontline communities and underserved communities, because I think that's exactly what we have to do. We have to make farming and the food system a really good place to work, a place where you can make a good living wage. And it's going to take a tremendous social investment. It's very clear that the private sector on its own is either unwilling or unable to bring about this transition. It's going to take public goods. It's going to take public policy. It's going to take reestablishing our public sphere where we come together and we make these decisions. We don't just leave them up to the market, because that means whoever has the most market power gets to decide the future of our society. And the last 30 years has shown us that that takes us down a very destructive path of no return.
Mm-hmm. And another thing you touched on that I think is really a very important issue is trying to bring all the wonderful nonprofits and great grassroots organizations that are out there together, so that everyone's not working in their own little silo, but that we're putting our power together to really create the social movement that we need to combat these big, big conglomerates that have so much money, because there's no way we're going to be able to get the kind of money they have. But we do have the numbers of people, but everybody's scattered. I feel like, there's so many different wonderful organizations, doing good work, but there are so many are doing similar work and we're not under one roof. Any suggestions on how to bring all these movements together so that we can really get together and make strides with the people power that we have?
Well, you sort of hit the nail on the head, Ronnie. That is the challenge. Back in the 30s, it was pretty clear political parties and unions were the way people got together and exerted political pressure. Well, our political parties are weak. Our unions are also weak. And so what you see is this sort of flowering of non-governmental organizations and community benefit organizations doing great work to address the immediacy of the problems of food access, of healthy food access and organic production and whatnot, but unable to come together to create the political power to change the rules, which is what we need to do. So I would say that we have to find ways to converge in all our diversity on one hand, and we really need to repoliticize our movements. And by that I mean so many of the movements, wonderful movements that we see today around food, farm, climate, gender, culture, have sort of taken their eyes off of capitalism. Precisely when capitalism has entered a phase in which it's privatizing everything on the planet and basically siphoning all of the wealth up to the 1%. And so we really do have to put our eyes back on the food system. It's a capitalist food system. Capitalism has co-evolved with our food system, so you can't change one without changing the other. The good news is that the food system is very strategically positioned to change everything, which is precisely why they don't want to mess with the rules, which is precisely why there's no way for a citizen to affect the farm bill. It's protected by a layer and layer of committee. They don't want democracy getting at the farm bill. So what do we do? Well, we do have to come together, and I would say on one hand, this Green New Deal offers a potential platform to bring us together. So I think we have to look very closely at that, and we have to find ways, right from our food policy councils, right on up to our national organizations, to come together and make sure it's a Green New Deal for the people and the planet and our food system that we need. And on the other hand, I think we have to look at our unions again. I mean, the retail industry, Walmart is the world's biggest employer, and retail is a big part of that. And we have to look at the retail industry, that includes Amazon, and help those workers organize and support those unions. I don't see how we could possibly change the food system without working with the workers of Walmart. I mean, it just boggles the mind to think that we could get anywhere without them. And yet you don't see a lot of linkages between food justice or slow food organizations with the workers of Walmart, the retail workers of Walmart. Well, we need to do that. We really do need the power of workers, the ones who really make things run and can shut things down in order to get demands addressed. We need that power, not just in the food movement, but in our society in general. So I think that the food sector and the food movement is an excellent place to begin to create the political consciousness and begin constructing the political alliances that we need for that big movement that that you refer to.
Yeah. You know, another thing, and I don't feel like we're going to really have time to delve into it, but, you know, does the New Green Deal address the structural racism that is so apparent in so many sectors of our world, you know, including the food system?
Well, not specifically, but it certainly does address it rhetorically. And I think that's the thing. I look at the Green New Deal. I think, for example, look, the exploitation of farm workers is what makes much of the industrial production of fruits and vegetables and meat run. If farm workers were not exploited, the playing field would be very different between smaller family farms and these huge conglomerates. And the way that that is permitted and held in place, that type of exploitation of immigrant farm workers, is through racism. Yes, we absolutely have to address racism, and we have to put it on the table, and that makes people uncomfortable, but we're going to have to deal with that. And I think the same thing with food access with underserved communities who are communities of color. You know, most of the people who are food insecure in this country, A, work in the food system, and B, are people of color. So that's institutional racism. So I think we absolutely do have to address racism in the food system. We have to address racism in the food movement. Who gets to speak? We have to address racism in our own organizations, who holds the power in our organizations, and we have to address racisms within ourselves. So for me, dismantling racism is not sort of extra work that we're going to do, after the environmental work, after the access work, after the technical work. No, it is the work, because if we don't do that, if we don't address racism and classism and sexism, we're not going to be able to come together. And we desperately need to come together, otherwise we won't have a powerful movement. So it is the work. And we need to integrate that into everything we do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they all have to happen kind of like simultaneously. That's the thing, that, you know, none of these are, you know, it's not linear. You know, it's not like in a timeline. It all kind of has to happen, you know, circular, at the same time, spiraling, including all of it and all the different parts as we move forward. And so we're just about out of time, Eric, but I want to thank you so much for coming on and for your incredible work and for, sharing these ideas and putting them into the minds of young people. I know you teach and you lecture and you're really, you know, putting this out there. And so the more people that hear your message and the message of others that are, you know, pushing this agenda forward, maybe we can make a change. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ravani. And I invite everybody to go to www.foodfirst.org.
Great. Yeah, and you can donate to your organization. And I know you have so much great information there. So thank you. And everybody listening out there, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I've been talking with Eric Holt Jimenez, the Executive Director of Food First. Have a great rest of the week and see you next week. I'm a